Thanks for inviting me. And like everybody else here, I too am interested in invasive species interactions. And I've been doing work in invasive systems, but from a more of a microbial perspective. And so what I'm going to show you today is some of the recent data that's been coming out of the work I've been doing, and then some sort of summarizing what's out there in the invasive plant literature that suggests that these plant microbial interactions may in fact be driving some of these ecosystem level dynamics that we're seeing with nutrient cycling changes. And I'll show you some of the first evidence that I have in the system I'm working in that suggests that in some cases these plant microbial interactions are actually driving these and enhancing some of these invasive plant characteristics. Of course, I think, why are we all interested in invasions in the first place? And this paper back in 2000 by Saxon Brown really summarized it quite eloquently, even in the title, The Paradox of Invasions. And it's this idea that invaders just don't play by the rules. You know, they don't seem to follow these rules of ecology that we think we sort of have somewhat of an understanding on. And this paradox they're referring to here is, how is it that these alien species or invaders can become so much more abundant even than the local natives, although they've had very little time to become locally adapted? And more recently, Ray Calloway, who's my major advisor at University of Montana, we expanded on this paradox concept, and this was recently came out in Science this summer, and specifically focusing on how this affects plants. And what we're seeing is really three very interesting characteristics across invaded ecosystems, across the various kinds of plant invaders. And those three things are, well, we see significant declines in diversity, we see significant increases in plant productivity, and some of us have been talking about this today in the biomass estimates, and we see these increases in soil nutrient pools. Now, I'll explain the first two of these with this graph. On the x-axis, we have, you know, diversity. So here, number of plant species. On the y-axis is productivity, so biomass. And this lower, if I can do this pointer here, this lower line is derived directly from Dave Tillman's work in native ecosystems, where as you increase productivity, or as you increase diversity, productivity goes up to a point. And what Ray and I were pointing out with this piece is that we're not finding that in invaded ecosystems. They're not following this guideline, if you will. And we see these spikes, about 80% increase in productivity in invaded ecosystems that are almost at near monocultures. And that's really counter to these concepts that, you know, at least David Tillman's been pointing out for the last 20 years. As far as this increase in the nutrient pools, well, that's been shown to be occurring in a lot of invaded ecosystems. This is a figure that's taken from the Liao paper in 2000, a meta-analysis of 94 invasion studies, and this is a lot going on. I just want to point out to a couple things. What they point out in this is that they see these increases, again, close to what we're showing, 83% in productivity across the invaded ecosystem, no matter what the invader, and that translates down to both increased soil microbial biomass, seen here, soil organic matter, and the bottom line is this translates into increased plant available forms of nitrogen in these soils. And all of this seems very counterintuitive at first glance. And just to point out, there are a lot of other studies, including my own work, that were not part of this meta-analysis where these findings are holding true. So why are we seeing this productivity, diversity, nutrient pool paradox? And to try to get at and answer that question, I want to talk about the system I work in as sort of a poster child and an example. I've been studying invasive sorghum, commonly known as Johnson grass. This is Sorghum halepens. And what you're seeing here is a site in a remnant tallgrass prairie in Fort Worth, Texas. So to the right of this flagging tape PVC line is the invaded sorghum. And we actually have a lot of history in this site. We know that 25 years ago, this was an intact remnant prairie dominated by the native grass, which you're seeing here on this side of the graph, or the line, which is Schizacrium scoparium, or little bluestem. And in this system, we're seeing, yep, major declines in diversity. I've been measuring plots out here since 2004 with my master's work. And we show that based on these Shannon diversity numbers, that the average species diversity is 36 different species per meter square plot, compared to 5 once invasive sorghum comes in. Biomass productivity is going up. In this system, I've measured about 75% increase in productivity in this system. And as for this nutrient pool thing, well, what did we find? Well, for the last 3 years, I've been measuring soil dynamics out here. And so I have a series of plots set up deep inside this native area, deep over here in this invaded area, and then along this interface that I'll refer to in the next couple of graphs as the transition zone. And we've been monitoring this on a quarterly basis for 3 years now. And what we found was actually shocking. I wasn't expecting to see what we found. And that is, well, let me take a minute to show this graph or explain the axis. The x-axis is the soil source, so N for native, T for that transition zone, I for invaded. And on the y-axis, we have the nutrients. So in this case, we've got nitrate, phosphate, and potassium, all of which have significantly increased in these invaded soils, as denoted by the different letters. But not just the plant big three are going up, not just N, P, and K. We also find the micronutrients in this system are going way up as well. Zinc, manganese, magnesium, and iron, seen here in this graph, is approaching near toxicity levels in these soils. So how do we explain this? How do we resolve something that was an intact, remnant, highly diverse prairie community that's now being replaced by a virtual monoculture of sorghum when we're seeing really significant changes to these below-ground nutrient pools and nutrient dynamics? Well, it was these shifts in the below-ground nutrient pools that started to get me to start to think about things not from more of a plant perspective, but plant interactions and microbial interactions, because after all, it's microbes that really drive all of these processes that we see occurring in soils. And being most interested in the nitrogen cycle, because nitrogen is the number one limiting resource in terrestrial ecosystems, at least, I started to look at this in much more detail, focusing on the microbial roles. And as I mentioned, I'm just going to show the nitrogen cycle is being heavily regulated by microorganisms. A wide range of bacterial genera are involved in this process, from atmospheric N2 fixation through ammonification, nitrification, back to denitrification. We've got a lot of different bacterial groups that do these processes. And I mentioned nitrate pools were significantly increasing in these sorghum invaded soils. So nitrogen's not the only, obviously, resource being cycled by microorganisms in soils. All of these nutrient pools are regulated by microorganisms. And so where I started to shift my thinking is actually here on these interactions, how these invasive plants might actually be interacting with their microbial symbionts in ways that may be exploiting more of a mutualistic interaction rather than the pathogens. And as I said, I've been very interested in the nitrogen cycle, and I started to look through the literature to try to find what was out there. What do we know about what's going on? How can we explain this? And I ran across a totally different system with sugarcane that actually helped me to sort of resolve what might be going on in the system. So just for a second, I'm going to jump ship, explain a little bit of how sugarcane relates to this and how I kind of came to where I'm at with this research now. So Saccharomyces cinerarum, sugarcane, not an invasive species, but a really important agricultural crop. And it's got some similarities that I find striking with invasive sorghum. One, it can be, although it's planted, it can attain these very dense stands. You know, sorghum does this on its own, but this can be planted very densely. Also, the biomass of this plant is enormous. This is about 3 meters in height, sorghum 2 to 3 meters in height. So there's some similarities there that caught my attention. What's interesting about sugarcane is that it's able to be planted in these very nitrogen-poor environments with little or no nitrogen fertilization input, like Brazil, Guyana, Hawaii's volcanic soils. Not only does it require little or no nitrogen fertilization, but oftentimes sugarcane can be planted to add nitrogen to soils. So it kind of seems odd considering the biomass and density that the plant's actually adding nitrogen. But it turns out it's because of this. This disease called red stripe disease, which is caused by this organism pictured here on the left, Urbis spirillum. And this is a microaerophilic endophytic bacteria, which just means that it doesn't like a lot of oxygen and it prefers to live inside of its plant hosts. That's the endophyte term. Although it can be found free living in soils. And it's this organism that's actually a pathogen to sugarcane, and you're seeing a sugarcane leaf that's been infected with this organism to the right of the midvein, to the left is a control, and you're seeing this red stripe or tissue necrosis. Well, the other interesting thing about Urbis spirillum is that it's not just a pathogen. It's also a nitrogen fixer. And it's this nitrogen-fixing organism that allows this sugarcane to be planted in these nitrogen-free environments. Now, you wouldn't know it if you went and yanked sugarcane out of the ground and looked for a nodule. You're not going to find one because these are non-nodulating endosymbionts. So I started to put all this together, this data coming out of the soils and this diversity losses in this native prairie ecosystem that I've been working in with sorghum, and then stumbling across this in the literature, not to mention that this is my sorghum growing in a growth chamber in or a greenhouse in Montana, clearly resembling that picture I just showed you of sugarcane red stripe. So it wasn't a no-brainer to start to test, maybe this plant's fixing nitrogen. So I basically tested that, and yes, this work came out just this year in Plant and Soil. If you want details about this, you can go to that. But we have shown that invasive sorghum is fixing nitrogen, and there's a seasonal signal healer. I just want to point out the tissues. You know, these are the different plant tissues we tested. We did this using the settling reduction assay method, which is just a surrogate for nitrogenase activity. And what we found is that there is an early, really high signal in this rhizomatous structure. These are underground stems of the plant, and I'll show you those pictures. But this is the clonal form of growth of this plant. So very high nitrogen fixation rates seem to be concentrating early in the growing season. So with that evidence, we started to go look for these bacterial endophytes like Herbosporium that we saw that were in sugarcane. And I don't have time to get into the methods of how we found these organisms, but we used a combination of culture techniques as well as 16S gene sequencing. And using the full near full-length gene sequence, we came with a 99% match or greater to these closest known relatives based on GenBank accession numbers. And there's some really interesting things known about these organisms. Some of them are known to fix nitrogen. Others aren't, but there's close relatives in their genus that do. Several can solubilize phosphate, respire nitrate, chelate iron, and four of the five are known to be IAA producers, which is a plant growth hormone, and a couple are known plant pathogens. In fact, the entire genus of xanthomonads are all plant pathogens. By the way, we did test all of our isolates in pure culture for the capability of infixation, and they all do test positive. So there's probably likely we have some unique strains on our hand, considering one's a Colobacter. With all of this in mind, I started to wonder if perhaps plant invasions may be driven more by these changing these interactions with these microbial symbionts rather than any plant-plant interaction in and of itself. And so to test that, I've done a series of manipulative ecological research where I show this plant with a little red on it as an endophyte plus E. You'll see kind of a couple of these series of plus E minus E studies. And that E stands for endophyte, so these bacterial endophytes. And what we expect if we manipulate the plant's endophytes is that we should see increased rates of nitrogen fixation, higher amounts of durin and sorgholione. Durin is a defense compound. It's a nitrogen-containing cyanide compound that sorghums have in their leaves. Sorgholione is its allelopathic compound that exudes from the root hairs. But increases in biomass, both in synthetic rates and competition. So I've been doing a series of manipulative growth chamber experiments to try to test this to pair with the field data that I'm finding. And so this first experiment, I'll just take a minute to explain the design because it kind of is essential to understand the data that's coming out of it. We have to maintain some sort of a sterile environment here. We are dealing with bacterial endophytes, and so I found these cheap Dixie cups that are actually autoclavable, and I was super excited. Unfunded graduate research projects, you can always get excited when you get out the cheap way. And so I filled them with triple autoclave silica sand that's sterilized. I surface sterilized seedlings and then allowed them to germinate under sterile conditions, and then aseptically transferred them once they were germinating into these sterile environments. And then I exposed them to this soil inoculum. This is soil that I took from that invaded Fort Worth field site that I showed you pictures of earlier. And the idea behind that is we know that we got at least five of these endophytes out of the plant rhizome. So where are they coming from? Are they coming from the soil? Are they recruiting? Or are they just bringing them with them and vertically transmitting them to their seeds? So that's kind of what we were testing here. So we gave them this soil slurry, and then I put it through a 5-micron filter so that I could get the fungus out. And so that's called ES, or endophyte from slurry. Endophyte from soil, excuse me. And then I put that same soil through a 2.2 micron sieve to remove those soil bacteria, but then I wanted to add back those five isolates that we originally got from the rhizomes, so to control what endophytes they could have access to. So that's EC, or endophyte from culture. And then finally, a third group was, again, a 0.2 micron sieve to remove bacteria, and then we didn't add anything back. We just put it on the plant. And these would be endophyte free or minus E if they aren't containing the bacterial endophytes in the seeds. So that's kind of how we were designing to test this. And then we wanted to measure nitrogen fixation and growth and some other stuff. So to do that, we had to put them through a series of nitrogen fertilization. So we had a complete fertilizer, and the only thing we changed, we either had really high levels of nitrogen or absolutely none. So here's what those looked like when they were growing. The upper bank of pictures are the ones that didn't get nitrogen. They're really skinny leaves. You can kind of see that they're kind of red. And the lower ones, a lot bigger, broader leaves, etc. And what do we find when it comes to growth? Well, this is showing the height of the plant over time. The solid bars, or the solid symbols, are the plants that got nitrogen. The ones that are open did not. No brainer here. You give plants nitrogen, they get bigger. Woohoo! Yay. But we knew that. But what we were surprised is that we didn't see a treatment effect from the endophytes from soil or the endophytes from culture or the minus endophyte treatment. So this actually suggests that these plants are, in fact, holding these endophytes in the seeds. Otherwise, this group down here that didn't get this minus C minus N circles, those should have been dead. But we actually confirmed this with acetylene reduction, and we measured the nitrogen fixation rates in these plants. And what you see here on the x-axis is the fertilizer, so high nitrogen or no nitrogen, and then this is the ethylene produced. And what we see is that regardless of treatment, so endophytes from the culture, endophytes from the soil, or these minus endophyte plants, they all had high rates of nitrogen fixation when you deprive them of nitrogen, about 5 times higher rate of infixation. And because these, particularly this group here, this dark gray one, the minus E ones were fixing, the only way they could be, because they were in a sterile environment, is if those were in the seeds. So we confirm vertical transmission here. We've also followed this up with some quantitative PCR work on the NIFH gene of the seeds, but I don't have time to show that data today. One surprising finding was that we even had any fixation at all going on with these ones that were getting high levels of nitrogen, very high levels. And in fact, we had a 33% rate of fixation there. It's a little surprising, and I'll return to that at the end. But we confirmed vertical transmission. I did mention I was interested to see if they were locally recruiting, and it turns out they're doing that too. What we have here is an ordination plot. This is the bacterial community structure. Using redundancy analysis of the denaturing gel gradient electrophoresis, or DGE, pattern dissimilarity. And that's a lot of words, and what is that? Well, basically this is a molecular technique that we use. What we did, each dot on this graph corresponds to a treatment. So, excuse me, we took those plants when we harvested them, and we extracted DNA from inside the plant tissues in the rhizomes, and we were looking for bacterial DNA. So we amplified that, we ran it on a denaturing gel, and we got a fingerprint, and it's the DGGE pattern. And then we put it through this bionumeric software where we pattern match analysis. And so all it does is it makes your DGGE data in a Euclidean plane, so you get XY coordinates, and those XY coordinates that are more similar to each other are closer to each other on the graph. And what this shows us is that these plants, the bacterial communities inside the plant rhizomatous tissues, is more similar to other plants that were experiencing the same substrate. So they're recruiting these partners from their environment. And not only that, the number of bacterial taxa that we found in these was increasing with respect to the increasing exposure that they were given to. So help support this. So we went back to repeat this to really get at these endophytes now. We knew there was vertical transmission. We wanted to cut off the endophytes. So we tried to use an antibiotic approach to do this. And we had to switch into a liquid or agar medium because you can't apply tetracycline to sterile sand and have any effect. But so the same process is applied, as I mentioned, on the first growth chamber experiment, only now we've gone into this agar medium. And then these seedlings were aseptically transferred into these magenta boxes, allowed to acclimate for 2 weeks, and then I hit them with the tetracycline, noted by the syringe here, to make these endophyte-free, if you will, plants. And I confirmed tetracycline actually worked on all of at least the 5 isolates that we got out of the rhizomes, so that I knew tetracycline would be effective. And here's what that looks like, just to give you an idea. Here they are in their little boxes, and you can see, you can't really see, unfortunately, from this. If we could dim the light, you could see it better. But the ones without nitrogen in their growing environment are starting to get red leaves already. And what we would predict to happen, so I have the high nitrogen plant regime on the bottom, nitrogen limited on the top, and based on the first experimental results, we would expect about 10 times more biomass if we gave it a lot of nitrogen. All right, so if they got their endophytes on board, we'd expect them to all grow, and then this would be you know, the size-wise. But if these endophytes are actually contributing to the invasive nature of this plant, helping it produce this biomass, then we should see two things. One, if we completely restrict nitrogen and we cut the endophytes back that are supplying that nitrogen in the fixed form, those plants should die. We should see very high mortality rates here. But in more importantly, in this high nitrogen regime, if nitrogen's really important to this plant for this massive amount of biomass that it puts on, we should see a significant drop in the growth, even under high nitrogen, when we knock those endophytes back. And what we found, basically to give up the ghost, is that our outcomes actually matched. A little wanky there on the minus nitrogen ones, but they started to die off quite dramatically towards the end of the experiment. What we see is this is the height of the plant over time, and this point here, this is just the seed, they were planted as little seedlings into these magenta boxes at day 7. They were given 2 weeks, and then the first round of tetracycline was given, and I did 2 rounds of tetracycline. And so the solid symbols are the plants that, with the endophytes intact, the open symbols are the ones that got tetracycline. And the bottom line is that regardless of nitrogen, high or low nitrogen, these plants are relying on these endophytes for significant contributions to their growth. And the mortality estimates were pretty staggering. We didn't have any mortality if we left the endophytes intact. We had high mortality rates when we knocked these endophytes back, specifically in the nitrogen-limited one, which makes sense. Well, this was kind of exciting, and this is kind of the first piece of evidence that suggests these bacterial endophytes are contributing to some of these invasive properties of the plant. But when we looked at root-shoot ratio, I actually got quite excited and surprised because we found a really big shift. So this upper part picture is just from the first growth chamber experiment, and I just wanted to show you that if you put nitrogen on these plants, it doesn't cause the resource allocation shifts. And that's supported here with this non-significant p-value and f-statistic. So basically, root-shoot ratio doesn't change in this upper group. But when we hit these plants with the tetracycline, and noted by the dark bars here, we found a significant decline in this root-shoot ratio. And that happened under high nitrogen environment and very limited nitrogen environment. And what's important about this, and very statistically significant, as noted by the p-value there, is that this was actually driven entirely by below-ground biomass. The plant did not shift resources away from its shoots. It shifted them entirely away from roots. 82% decline in this rhizome and root biomass. And that is huge. So to summarize what we found, the field study showed, you know, we've got losses in diversity, increases in productivity, and increases in all these nutrients. Okay, this is fitting into this weird paradox. Using settling reduction assay, culture techniques, and 16S sequencing, we've confirmed that these rhizomes of this plant are having a very high seasonal signal of nitrogen fixation. We isolated these 5 bacterial endophytes from those rhizomatous tissues, and all of those bacteria were capable of infixation in pure culture, we confirmed. I didn't show that data today. And that we used the 16S near-folding gene sequence to make these identity matches. With respect to the growth chamber experiments, I know I look very angry in that picture, but I was probably standing in a fire ant mound while that picture was being taken. We found that with that first chamber experiment, the endophytes are being vertically transmitted as confirmation with those minus E plants capable of the 5x rate of fixation. We've also confirmed with quantitative PCR using molecular techniques that the NIFH gene is in a bunch of these seedlings across a wide range of populations from the southern United States, but I didn't have time to show that data. The DGGE pattern matching ordination shows that these endophytes can be locally recruited as well, which was another surprise to us. No alteration of resource allocation with respect to fertilization, but 5x higher rates of fixation in these plants when you deprive them of nitrogen. And the surprising thing, and I said I would return to this, is that we found nitrogen fixation even under high nitrogen conditions, which suggests, I call it the sorghum's the teenager with a bad bank account, you know. You give your kid $20, he spends $20. You give him $100, he spends $100. And that's kind of where it seems like sorghum's doing with nitrogen. You give the resource to the plant, it utilizes everything it has access to. Because otherwise, nitrogen fixation, it's costly, it's shut off when there's exogenous nitrogen available. And then finally, the second growth chamber experiment showed that, you know, these endophytes are causing significant increases in the plant's growth. And we tested that under very limited nitrogen and very high nitrogen, and that held true. And more importantly, that this resource allocation is occurring, significantly altering the below-ground biomass that the plant puts on. So who cares, and why is this important? And I guess I'll leave you with this picture. That's a sorghum rhizome. That's what this plant can produce, upwards of 60 to 90 meters of these things in a growing season. And I didn't speak incorrectly. I do mean meters. They put them out, and they go sort of vertically, like in the top 15 centimeters of the soil. So you go and try to disc this up. You try to pull this out. Good luck, because you've just created every one of these nodes. You've got a new clone, which is part of the reason why this plant is so hard to eradicate, not to mention the allelopathic properties and the defense compound and the leaves. It's got a suite of things it's using. And the work that I'm doing, which we're actually testing those durin concentrations, the allelopathic chemical exudation under these regimes, although that data isn't in yet, so I can't even speculate where the direction that's going. But what we're finding, at least with respect to biomass and infixation, is that this plant is relying on these bacterial endophytes for these significant increases in growth. And looking at plant microbial interactions in invaded systems may actually help us go into the new frontier, if you will, of ways of eradication. Because it looks like invasive plants in general, you know, I've just talked in detail about sorghum, but this idea of these paradoxical things that are occurring are happening across a large range of invasive plant species, across a large variety of ecosystems. So if we can use sorghum as sort of a poster child here to see what's going on, then it might open up the world of, you know, expanding this interactions and microbial interactions with plants as a possible way, eventually, of gaining some kind of control. And with that, I'd like to say thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
We have time for a few questions.
Yes.
So is this unique to the rhizomes of the sorghum, or would you expect it in other sorghum species?
So it turns out that this sorghum is a hybrid between grain sorghum, sorghum bicolor, and sorghum propinquum. And bicolor has actually shown to have erbospirillum, although bicolor is not rhizominous. It does not produce those. I honestly think that nitrogen fixation and is very common with a lot of grasses, and there's a lot of work out there that supports this, that there's probably a lot of bacterial endophytes that are capable of getting into the plant tissues, not forming nodules. The question I'm looking at is, I think invaders may be sort of capitalizing on these interactions, exploiting more of these mutualistic interactions just because of this lack of coevolution. Yeah.
Is your interpretation of that root shoot ratio change that the endosymbionts are not present and therefore there's a lower production of the plant tissue where they live?
Yeah, and actually there's a couple things to that. So I mentioned this IAA production, and I'm measuring that now. And IAA, the precursor to IAA, is ethylene. Ethylene is a plant signal dye. And under stress conditions, this is signaled. And what's happening is that these bacteria are scavenging that ethylene. The signal's not getting to the plant, so you can just continue to put on growth and put on growth. And a lot of that's transformed into root biomass, at least in a lot of the other agricultural studies that I've read out there. So I'm actually trying to manipulate that now to see if that's what's going on. But I do think these rhizomes are sort of this giant starchy housing structure where there's probably an exchange of carbon to the bacteria in exchange for nitrogen to the plant. But they're obviously very expensive. And if you aren't getting, you know, we know that rhizobium are monitored by plants. And if they're not cutting the mustard with nitrogen inputs, plants will shut off the nodules. So there may be something similar going on here. So yeah, I think it's a warehouse, if you will, for the microbes.
How does the species behave, or related species in the native habitat? And are they, do they fix? And also, what kind of specialist herbivores like them?
Well, I'll answer your herbivore question first, because it's the most direct. There aren't any herbivores that like this plant, because the cyanide compound is so high in it. The durin is constitutive defense, and so it'll continue to produce durin in the leaves, which is the cyanide container, until it's about 80 centimeters tall. So it's very toxic. It's more of a refuge for herbivores.
Even its native habitat.
Well, that's the million-dollar question, because it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid between these two sorghums. The first sign of it was about 2,000 to 5,000 years ago in Turkey. the introduction of sorghum. And there really isn't a known native habitat. It's invasive in 54 countries, so it's kind of a problem everywhere. And I would love to find out if it's fixing everywhere. I think it is, but I think probably because of this recruitment thing, it's recruiting whatever's locally available. But I wish I could test it with this. Unfortunately, there's really no native land for this plant.
We should move on to the next speaker.
Okay. Thank you.